was here 10 years ago, so I'm very happy to come back and visit. This place is great. And what I want to discuss is about dissipative processes during inflation. And this talk is essentially divided in three parts. The first part, which will be the major part, is non-Gaussianity and other observables that come related to axial inflation. In the second part, I will focus on source gravity waves at CMB scales. And in the third part, I will revisit a nice model of inflation, which is trapped inflation, in which dissipation plays a relevant role for the dynamics. And as I prepared the talk, I decided to list all the collaborators in the papers that are mentioned in the talk. I've been fortunate to work with great people. And I also want to emphasize my two students. One is Rio Namba, who is doing a postdoc at Montreal, starting from the fall. And the other is Kane Runal, who is a finishing student and has been involved in all my papers recently. So, let me start with something that we all know. This is essentially the Planck data compared to some models. And what I want to emphasize, right, is that we have very simple properties for primordial perturbations. They are nearly scale invariant, so ns nearly equal to 1. And the tensor mode is much smaller than the scalar mode. So this is encoded in parameter r, which is smaller than 1. Moreover, we see that there is really no observed departure from primordial Gaussianity. So the primordial modes are consistent with Gaussian, and this is best tested from the three-point function. These properties are in agreement with the standard single-field slow roll models of inflation. So the simplest model you can write down predicts precisely these properties there, where there is the slow roll parameter and all the quantity r, ns minus 1, fnl, they are of the order of slow roll parameters. So you get compatibility with what you observe. Now, you can imagine looking at the action for the perturbations, which is going to be the quadratic action, the free action, plus the interaction. And as we know, right, if you have a field that is essentially free, then it's going to be Gaussian. So the observed smallness of non-Gaussianity is essentially telling us that the inflaton was interacting very little during inflation. Of course, there is gravitational interactions, but gravity is weak. And self-interactions are constrained by slow roll. For example, if you have large field inflation, you know lambda has to be smaller than 10 to the minus 13 for a quartic operator, which just gives us a measure of how weakly self-coupled the inflaton is. And of course, these leave rooms for interactions with other fields. You know, typically, you want the inflaton to interact for reheating. And so the question you can ask is, what if there are some interactions that are somewhat effective also during inflation? And in this talk, I'm going to look at three types of class of models. The first one is a pseudoscalar inflaton coupled to FF tilde. This will give us reheating in inflation, but also can give signatures during inflation, like non-Gaussianity and change in the primordial power spectrum, gravity waves, primordial black holes. And in the second part, I'll discuss a variant of this, where sigma is not the inflaton. And despite a lot of analogy, this plays a crucial role for the observations. And I will argue that is one of the few cases where you can generate source gravity waves at CMB scales that evades a lot of constraints. Finally, in the final part, I will review some work that I'm about to post related to trapped inflation.
Marco, can I just ask you, on the second of the points, self-interactions are constrained by slow roll, but the constraint you quote is from the amplitude of density perturbation, nothing to do with whether the field slow rolls or not.
That's correct. That's wrong word. You're right. The statement stays, but the explanation is, you're right. Absolutely. Thank you. So, axial inflation, right, is a very well-known class of models. There's been a lot of work on them. And this is essentially characterized by an effective action, which is like the one you see above there. And this is starting from the work by Fries and collaborators, but there's been a lot of activity in it. And what is used in axial inflation is that the breaking of the shift symmetry can be technically naturally small, right? If you have only a sector of your theory that breaks the shift symmetry, any loop correction to that potential would be proportional to the potential itself. That's the usual argument advocated why these models can be interesting. What is also interesting from my point of view is that there is a predictivity in the coupling of the axion to matter, right? If you have worked on reheating, you know that one of the big problems is that you don't have really much predictivity. You have a lot of model dependence. Here you have symmetries that essentially allow you to get some constraints and more predictivity. For example, you can see that if you just write those operators, which are the first dimension 5 operators that appear for the inflaton, so F is a mass scale, you can see that the decay into fermions is elicity suppressed. An axion cannot, a pseudoscalar cannot decay into massless fermions. In this way, we see that the coupling to gauge fields should be the dominant operator. C psi and CA, of course, can be different, but we expect them to be of order 1. More recently, it was realized that essentially phi is true that this decay controls reheating, but it was more recently realized that this can be also interesting during inflation, and that's what I'm going to review right now. To see this, let's just look at the quadratic action for the gauge field. We just treat phi at the moment as a homogeneous classical field, so phi acts as a function of time only in this slide here. And what we can see that thanks to the last term, you are going to change the dispersion relation for the vector field. This parameter psi is proportional to phi dot, right? If phi is exactly constant, this is a total derivative. It will not affect the equations of motion. But the motion of phi generates this third term. And as we are going to discuss later, psi is an order 1 parameter. It needs to be of order 1. Therefore, you have that the last term is essentially A is the scale factor, H Abel rate, K wave number. The last term is irrelevant when you are inside the horizon, but when you cross the horizon, the last term becomes dominant and one of the two elicities becomes tachyonic. So here it's how the plot works. On the horizontal scale is the wavelength divided by the horizon, essentially. So what I have is a measure of time. And this region here is inside the horizon. This region here is outside the horizon. This is horizon crossing. And what I'm showing there is the energy density in one single mode, is the physical energy density. So here is the UV contribution. Here is when the last term is not relevant yet. This is the usual problem of the cosmological constant or the vacuum energy. This will need to be renormalized away. But then you can see a bump due to the particle production, due to the field excitation due to the last term. And you can check that the amplitude is exponentially sensitive to this parameter psi. After a while, you also see that the physical energy density decreases. This is due to the expansion of the universe. And actually, in this mode, you can see from the equation, the instability is not strong enough to fight against the expansion of the universe. Eventually, the universe will dilute the energy density in that mode. But this plot is only for one single mode. So later during inflation, there will be other modes that cross the horizon at this later time. However, this ensures that we don't have singularities in the infrared, because in the infrared, everything just dies away. So now let's look at the perturbations of the inflaton. These vector fields get diluted away, but before getting diluted away, they have the chance to inverse decay and to produce perturbations of the inflaton field. And this is the diagram, and this is essentially the equation where I ignore metric perturbations. We are going to be looking at the values of the coupling that are stronger than gravitational. And you can obviously, as you can imagine, you can verify that gravitational interactions are subdominant for the source terms, and we can disregard metric perturbations. So there is going to be this differential equation, right? There is homogeneous plus particular solution. The homogeneous solution is the usual vacuum solution, and the particular solution is the one driven by the source, the inverse decay. And you get that the two terms are uncorrelated. They have different annihilation creation operators. So when you compute the endpoint function, is the separate sum of the two endpoint functions. So this is rather simplification in the calculation.
Can I ask one more question?
Absolutely.
In this picture where the modes that are crossing the horizon at a particular time have this advanced energy density, how does the total energy density?
I will discuss, it's a very good question. I will discuss this in a couple of slides, three, four slides. At the moment, let me give you the partial answer and then I'll give you a better answer in a moment. But let me finish this discussion. Here is the total power spectrum, which is the sum of the vacuum plus the source modes. And this expression is only valid for psi greater than 1. There is no divergence at psi is equal to 0. Psi is equal to 0 means no particle production. And you see that essentially you need to be where the sum of the two is co-normalized. So that actually there is a two-dimensional space, this coupling psi, the normalization of the vacuum mode, we need to live here. And you can see here there is no field excitation. So essentially here the vacuum modes are co-normalized. And then as you increase the production, you're going to get essentially that you need to decrease exponentially the scale of the vacuum modes. This is the region where the energy density that of the produced gauge fields back reacts on the zero mode of the inflaton field. In this case, when we look at these values here at CMB scale, we are not yet worried about the energy density in this gauge field. But as I'm going to discuss in a few slides, this is going to be relevant in the later stages of inflation. But when we look at the CMB scale, we are still in this region here. Now, how we constrain this? By computing the non-Gaussianity. The source modes are highly non-Gaussian. And as you saw from the previous slides, at any given moment, only modes comparable size of the horizon are present. So when the inverse decay, they produce inflaton perturbations, which also have a mode comparable to that size. So at any given moment during inflation, you can only imprint correlations between modes of comparable size. That's why non-Gaussianity in this model is approximately equilateral. And when you compute the amount of non-Gaussianity on the red curve where you need to live, you get, for the parameter FNL, you get the numbers that I'm writing there. And essentially, you can see you need to live in the regions, of course, on the left, because roughly speaking, FNL has to be less than about 100. Notice that there is a very tiny region in parameter space where you get this. And this is because the amplitude is exponentially proportional to the parameter psi. So here is what you get in specific models of inflation. P is equal 1 is a linear inflaton potential. P is equal 2 is a quadratic inflaton potential. And the psi of order 1 is reached when f over alpha is of order 10 to the 16 GeV. When f is large, in these relatively larger, you have no field amplification, so nothing interesting is happening. And then all of a sudden, a small changes of f will give a very strong amount of field amplification. So non-Gaussianity grows exponentially until it gets a saturation. But also what you notice here is that the tensor to scalar ratio decreases. This is because you are sourcing more scalar perturbations than gravity waves. So this is the limit where there is more production.
There's a question about that. Actually, that I'm not actually familiar with how non-Gaussianity is calculated in these models. If I want to calculate the three-point function of the amplitron,
yes,
then is the leading diagram the one that has like three external amplitrons and then one each?
Correct.
Diagram?
Correct. You get essentially G. Delta A, it is going to be the green function, and you're going to get this diagram here.
Yeah. So does that give you that diagram?
Yes, because, well, I think by construction, we are just looking, you see, remember the energy density in the A mode that was doing something like that. And we are just going to concentrate on this piece here. We are essentially, because otherwise, even if there was no particle production, it would get infinity. But that's not really, that has to be renormalized away. So to do practically, I believe that in the calculation, we only put a cutoff here.
Okay.
So we are concentrating on the effect of the source vector field.
Can you explain there why the more particle production leads to smaller R?
I'm going to discuss this much more in the second part of my talk. But essentially, the quick answer is that in this model, the inflaton is directly coupled to the vector field. The vector field sources both inflaton perturbations and gravity waves. But the gravity wave coupling is gravitational, so it's weaker. Therefore, the total tensor divided by the total scalar decreases. I'm going to discuss this at length in later on. Let me make a comment, and also let me advertise my last paper on that subject. Now, you know that in the simplest model of natural inflation, the one by Kate and collaborators, essentially F, the axion decay constant, needs to be greater than about 7 M Planck. But here I've discussed limits that are valid when F is 10 to the minus 2 M Planck. So the limits that I'm considering are relevant for models which have a sub-Planckian axion scale, but an effective large field excursion. Examples of these models are monodromy, inflation, and aligned natural inflation. Now, let me comment a little more aligned natural inflation. It's a very very simple idea, almost trivial. When you see there is a potential for two axions, and you can have some combination which ensures that one axion is lighter than the other one. Particularly, you can really see that when F1 divided by G1 is equal to F2 divided by G2, one linear combination drops of the potential. So let's assume that this is not really exactly equal, but they are approximately equal. Then you can get an enhanced effective axion scale. As you can see from the contour plot there, you get one direction which is lighter than what you would naively guess from the original scales. Now, last year, there were a lot of papers that discussed that this can still have a problem with the instanton corrections if the F effective is greater than M Planckian. But here, let me just take this potential at face value. I want to make some comment on the phenomenology of this potential. So this is a paper that we did with Kanner last year. Alpha is this aligned parameter. When alpha is equal to zero, you get one flat direction. So essentially, you have that one scale is effectively enhanced by the smallness of alpha. Psi is the linear heavy combination. Phi is the linear light combination. And here, I'm showing a contour plot in rescaled units. Phi divided by F phi, psi divided by f psi, such that here they look like if they have the same curvature. This is a fundamental periodicity region, maximum, minimum, saddle points. And inflation in this model, psi, remember, this is a rescale plot, but in reality, psi is much heavier than phi. So inflation occurs in two valleys that minimize the potential with respect to psi. And here is an example for some choices of parameters. There are many parameters in the model where you have two different possible evolutions. And the green are valleys. These are regions that minimize the potential with respect to psi. Magenta are crests. These maximize the potential with respect to psi. So inflation can only take place on valleys. But here you can see that this simple model of two axions has some valley that is connected to a minimum, but it also has some valley that starts from a saddle point and that it dies in nowhere, like a waterfall. This is very similar to hybrid inflation. What you can have for this second solution, you can have that all of inflation can take place in the top of the mountain. So you get a phenomenology which is very similar to top hill inflation. And what is good with that is that it can give us a very small tensor to scalar ratio. Now, one problem of natural inflation, unfortunately, is that it starts to be a little bit in tension with the data, not yet too much, but starting. So this dotted black line is the prediction for natural inflation, single cosine term. All these colored lines are for the model, for the directions, for the line inflation, for the connected solutions. But here you can see that this is a zoom up of this region here. If you have disconnected solutions, you can have a much smaller tensor to scalar ratio. This natural inflation is out now from the 1 sigma of Planck. With the latest Keck array data, this plot even goes farther down. So it may be that in some time, only solutions like this will be available because you need to reduce the tensor to scalar ratio.
Is there any limits on a large?
Well, we have an analytic constraint. I don't remember exactly how it goes, to be honest. I don't remember the. I have an analytic solution, so I can discuss this later. I don't remember it.
Yeah, it's not easy to read the y-axis, but the numbers are all very close to each
other. Oh, I'm sorry. So these are 0.94 to 0.99. So 94, 0.95, 0.96.
The y-axis.
Y-axis, 2 times 10 to the minus 2, 4 times 10 to the...
I'm sorry.
10 to the minus 2. 2 times 10 to the minus 3, 4 times 10 to the minus 3. Yes, it is not... at focus, yes. But what I want to see is that this region here is a zoom out of this region here. So we can have really lines in the middle there. But let me go back to the main subject. This was just to advertise our last paper. There's going to be another interesting effect that starts to answer to the question you made, associated with the fact that the inflaton speeds up during inflation. So the amplitude of the inflaton speeds up in a slow way, but the amplitude is exponentially proportional to the speed of the inflaton. So you can get other interesting signatures. For example, since the inflaton speeds up, what you're going to get that this parameter that controls the source mode is going to increase. And this will lead to increase of the power already at the small CMB scales. And what they did at Planck, they did a constraint on this parameter xi, both from non-Gaussianity and both from the increase of the power spectrum. And you can see that the increase of the power spectrum is just a little bit more sensitive to than non-Gaussianity, although this is quite close parametrically. And this is the limit that they obtain. These are quoted from Planck papers on this model.
Why do you get a lower bound?
That's very cute, and that's something that that I want to think about. I believe that the reason is that these models here of large field inflation, they start to be in disagreement with the data. So having a little bit of particle production, for a reason that I can maybe, it's very technical, I can discuss later on, the changes the starting point of position of the inflaton in a region where probably this tensor to scalar ratio is slightly smaller. It's a very technical answer, and I don't think that there is a huge evidence because this is very close to zero. But for reasons that are really technical, and I will discuss maybe later if you want in person, this power spectrum grows due to particle production, but before growing goes a little bit lower, just because you change the starting point of inflation. It's very cute, yes.
Is there some difference between things this high and, you know, just
this is a very heavy axiom. So this is something that has 10 to the 13 mass. So you would not produce, GV. You would not really produce this in stars. So this is the same models as QCD, but on a different time, on a different mass scale.
The way you describe it, so what three-point function should I look for?
Yes.
The way you describe it here kind of makes it sound like you could give extra scale invariance to that collateral three-point function that goes like an arbitrary power.
That also can change the scale. That's perfectly correct. Yes. Typically, it is still small on the large scales, but you are right. Also, the scale of the bispectrum is going to change. That's correct. But phi dot keeps increasing, so this gives a rather unique opportunity to probe the latest stages of inflation, maybe. Typically, the final parts of inflation are very unconstrained, but now in these models here, phi dot keeps increasing, so this naturally leads us to ask, can I get something from the much smaller scales? And the problem is there, the equation for the inflaton perturbations becomes much more complicated because xi is growing, so delta A is growing, and you expect more corrections to appear in the equation for the inflaton perturbations. And the one that I'm showing there is an effective equation that was first postulated by Amber and Sorbo. And they just say, since phi dot controls xi, well, the first thing that I'm going to do, I'm just going to look at delta xi, which will be proportional to delta phi dot, and this will give me a coupling between delta phi dot and the source. So this would be an extra term that starts appearing from higher order interaction terms. So let's just take this equation that they just argued should be a reasonable approximation. What Linde, Mugi, and Pager did, they took this equation and they solved it at very late times, and they obtained a growth of the power spectrum. So this is the growth that we would use by Planck to just constrain the mode. But then if you keep going at smaller and smaller scales, the scalar power spectrum is growing until, due to that present term there, is going to saturate. Now, if you take this solution, if you believe in that equation, and you compare it with the primordial black hole limit, you get a limit on xi at the CMB scales, 1.5. This limit here, however, is not totally sure. In their paper, Linde et al. Paper, they comment on this. They're very honest on this. And they say that since the equation is not fully known, an order one change in the result may give a different change in the limit of psi. So the message from here is that primordial black holes can be really used to constrain the model just due to the growth of the power spectrum. If this equation is to be trusted as it is, you would get a limit psi smaller than 1.5 at CMB scales. However, there are order one uncertainties in this, but at least, so that this limit has to be taken with caution.
If I want to evade this limit, I can just say that my phi is coupled to f half, not as phi times f half, but some function of phi times f half.
You can change this, and also this is, I believe, for a quadratic in photon potential. Of course, if you could change the potential, the speed up is different. So you see, one thing is the CMB scales, one thing is the primordial black hole scale. This is the number of EFOs during inflation. So in principle, right, it's not that there is a one-to-one relation that is always valid, but you can explore this within given models. But what I want to do, actually,
in this picture, it seems a bit of a coincidence that those theoretical ones are saturating at a level which is more or less the same level that the more practical strength is at. That is just a coincidence.
As far as I know, yes. But maybe someone who knows this better may say no.
I can't see there's any relationship. I'm not sure why these lines have become so flat again.
Well, they become flat due to that extra friction term. The second term there provides a friction that essentially doesn't allow the perturbation to grow beyond a certain amount.
So that term has been stronger, saturated to a lower level.
Well, that's what you see here. It's very much independent on psi. You can show that the saturation value is just a constant. And you can work this out analytically. Now, so this saturation, you can really show that will not depend on psi, and is a regime where that term becomes important. It's a new solution where that saturation matches the source, in a sense. Now, how you compare, why this is very close to the primordial black hole limit, I don't know. And to me, it seems just that it's coincidental, but maybe it's not. So I don't know. It's very important, I remember, to get their limit. They are using the fact that the source perturbations are highly non-Gaussian. If you just use a naive black hole limit, assuming Gaussianity of the perturbations, you get a more relaxed value. But here it was important when they did that limit that the perturbations were non-Gaussian. That's all I can really say right now.
How big is the
vector
field for that whole story?
It starts to be relevant and affect the background dynamics.
Then once it gets bigger than background mass, why don't you start curvatures in particles with a short field?
This is something that I don't believe it has been discussed. At the moment, this is just a vector field, and we are not committing about the fermionic content. But this is something that could be interesting to explore, I think. At the moment, we are just saying there is a vector field that doesn't need to be our photon, and there may be a fermionic content, but then it's open question. I agree with you. It's in principle it's something that is worth thinking, maybe.
I think maybe I should start a paper on that.
Okay. I know he did some papers. I don't remember if he touched on this point. What I want to discuss, I want to compare this mechanism, the primordial black hole production, with the possibility of production of gravity waves. What is interesting, as was noted by Lorenzo, Cook, and Sorbo in that paper particularly, the vector field also produces gravity waves, and the gravity waves are chiral. And they can grow at interferometer scales. And with Neil and Enrico, we just did an update of their calculation. And here you cannot see much because there is some green line, which is very hard to see. But this is essentially a linear inflaton potential for some given value of psi. Now, if you could see the green line, I don't know if you can see it. The red line is the evolution of the inflaton without particle production. The green line is the evolution of the inflaton with the particle production in 10 ZR. And here you can see, that's probably the best thing to see, as a function of the number of EFOs, the value of phi dot. Phi dot here is the derivative of the inflaton in the case in which there is no gauge field production. You see the inflaton speeds up during inflation.
In red is the derivative of the inflaton in presence of particle production. You see, towards these stages here, particle production starts to control the motion of the inflaton field. This answers the question you were asking me before. Because psi is growing, right? The inflaton is speeding up, psi is growing, and you enter in a new attractor regime. This has to be taken into account to compute the gravitational waves. And here is, from our paper, the spectrum of gravitational waves that you would produce in this model there. This is for some given value of psi. Notice here, I'm speaking about values of psi of the order 2.5 or 2.3. which are a weaker limit than the primordial black hole limit, but these calculations don't have any problem in the equation of motion for the graviton. And here, in principle, you can have a signal that can be close to ELISA or to advanced LIGO scales. Last week, there was a paper by Binetri and collaborators which updated these results, and they also took the same equations and they just updated the calculations. Something that was curious is that, in principle, there is an extra signature. Suppose that at LIGO they find stochastic background. How can you convince them that it is cosmological, right? That will be very hard to just say, yeah, yeah, I'm sure this is what I predicted. But what is interesting in these models is that the gravity wave background is chiral. So you can, in principle, there's not going to be astrophysical sources that do this. So in principle, you can look for a second term, this pi term. This is how you would correlate signaling to interferometers, where pi gives the measure of chirality violation. And to determine the two parameters, omega and pi, you need three detectors. So because you need not just one correlation. And however, soon we will have a network of gravity wave interferometers. So Seto and Taruya, they did the formalism to how you're going to search for pi. These gamma are functions that they depend on the relative orientation of the detectors and on the distance of the detector versus the wavelength of the gravity wave. And we teamed up with Mandic and Crowder. These are people in LIGO collaboration, to do an update on the Seto and Taruya analysis. And we worked out what are the limits, essentially, for detecting chirality violation. So let's assume that, as in the axion inflation, I have a signal of gravity waves pi is equal 1, maximally chirality violation. How large does the signal need to detect gravity waves and to exclude pi is equal 0 at 2 sigma? And we did two things. Here is just a generic power law frequency. Here is how big the signal needs to be, 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 12, 10 to the minus 14, omega gravity waves. And here is for axion inflation. So you can get limits that approaches 2. These are, again, weaker than the black hole limits, but more sure. So in principle, if you had a number like this, you could be able to detect a chiral gravitational background from interferometers. Let me move to the second part of my talk. And I want to discuss gravity waves. So far what I discussed, right, that there's going to be a weak production of gravity waves at CMB scales. And what we showed in the last few slides is that if the inflaton speeds up, you can have greater production of gravity waves at interferometer scales. Now the question remains, which is a very interesting question, whether we can produce gravity waves at CMB scales. As we know, right, this is something that has not been yet observed. We have the limit. With the latest Keck array data, now you get the figure there. You go from red to blue, which is giving us a 2 sigma r smaller than 0.07. And as we know, there is a huge experimental activity to detect this signal. And I stole this slide from Page in Ferrara, end of 2014. And you can see there a list of a lot of ground-based experiments and balloon experiments. Some of them are taking data. Some of them are more in planning. And also there is a proposed satellite experiment, like a Lightbird, for example. But this one just to show that there is a huge experimental activity, as we know. And as we know, the key is going to be multi-frequency, because we need to eliminate, to clean the dust, right? So the dust has a different spectral dependence. And therefore, if you measure more frequencies, hopefully you can distinguish dust from primordial signal. Why there is such a big experimental activity? Because, of course, the payoff would be enormous, right? The amount of gravity waves in the standard models of inflation is just proportional to the expansion rate. Therefore, it's just proportional to the potential of the inflaton. So if you know gravity waves, you'll know the scale of inflation. And then there is the very nice light bound that relates the field excursion to the measured values of gravity waves. If you measure r greater than 10 to the minus 2, you know that delta phi is going to be greater than M Planck. Now, the question is how robust these relations are. Suppose that they find gravity waves, so they find r different from 0. Are we sure that these relations will be valid? That's essentially the question. And, you know, theoreticians have a lot of imagination. There has been a lot of models that generate sourced gravity waves. Here, I'm going to only discuss a subset of models. It's the subset of models that have standard general relativity, standard quantum mechanics, and they are models on which I worked, so I have something to say. But I believe that what I'm saying is quite general for many models. There's going to be models like the one of trapped inflation. I'm going to discuss it in the next slide. The second is the model that we worked out. And then there is a model that I will not have time to discuss by Biagetti, Fasiello, and Riotto. They have a field which have a low sound speed. And by having low sound speed, it can produce high gravity waves. But what all these mechanisms have in common is that there is a field X. This field X is produced somehow during inflation, and this X generates gravity waves which are much greater than the vacuum modes of the metric. Now, this is not really the real question, because, you know, as I say, we are imaginative people, and we can always put a source that produces gravity waves. It's not simple, but you can do it. But the real question is not this. The real question is this. What is the amount of source gravity waves versus the amount of source scalar perturbations? Because whatever X is going to be gravitationally coupled to the metric, but it's going to be coupled at least gravitationally to the source of scalar perturbations, which let me assume to be the inflaton field. And this is something that we have insisted since quite some time, actually, that if you have mechanisms that generate source gravity waves, you better also compute the source scalar perturbations, because at the end is a fight between the two. You will not want to produce too many of these guys, because these guys are non-Gaussian, and they're just going to give the limit on the mechanism. So let's discuss a moment, because I'm going to need this discussion for the second part and also for the third part. Let's discuss the model that you see there, where there is a burst of particle production during inflation. So phi is the inflaton, chi is another field. Phi star is a number. It's a number that phi crosses during inflation. For most of the evolution, phi, of course, is different than phi star, and the field chi is just massive and is just leaping. It's not doing really anything. It's in its vacuum mode, because phi is big and it varies slowly. However, there's going to be a moment where phi is equal to phi star. At this moment here, you have an unadiabatic evolution of the mass of the field chi, which results in a burst of particle production, as was worked out in these very nice papers that I'm writing there. So there is going to be like a Gaussian profile for the field chi that switches on as soon as phi crosses phi star. This field can be used to produce inflaton perturbations, and I'm going to discuss this in the final part of my talk, but this can also be source of gravity waves. This was discussed by Cook and Sorbo and by Senatore, Silverstein, and Zaldarriaga. And also what Cook and Sorbo did, they discussed a version of this model where there are vector fields. But essentially, this gives the same result. And for the following slide, please keep in mind that the quanta of the field chi, or A mu, they are produced when they are massless, when the phi is equal to phi star. But then very quickly, phi moves past phi star, and this quanta become non-relativistic. You can actually check it in these models that as soon as the quanta are produced, they immediately become non-relativistic. You can compute the typical momentum, the typical mass. And so you are speaking about non-relativistic particles as soon as they are produced. And if you read their papers, you find that there is very small gravity waves produced in these models. And by reading them, I could not understand why. So this prompted us to study these mechanisms further. And the question is, why don't you produce a lot of gravity waves in these models? And we came out with a series of rules, if you want, or at least conditions under which you can increase the amount of gravity waves relative to the scalar perturbations. The first thing you should probably do, you should have that the source of gravity waves should only be gravitationally coupled to the inflaton. In this way, you don't have a direct coupling between the inflaton field and the source of gravity waves. For example, here you can imagine you have a second field sigma. This second field sigma is moving and is the one that generates the field A. Now, how do I see this, right? Typically in string-motivated models of inflation, we have a lot of moduli. And then we assume that n minus 1 of them are stabilized and one is moving, for example. But let me assume that maybe at the beginning of inflation, which needs to be tuned to match where we observe, there is another field that is about to get stabilized. It's going to be moving for a little. And this is going to happen in a sector that is only gravitationally coupled to the inflaton. But now let's also move to the calculation. You can write the equation for the canonical modes of inflaton of gravity waves. And they are just an equation is equal to a source. This is the source for scalar perturbations. This is the source for gravity waves. And when the source is non-relativistic, essentially taking a time derivative of the source is like multiplying by the mass of the source. So these terms here just cancel when the source is non-relativistic. And then you can see that the source of inflaton perturbations is the mass, right? Scalar perturbations care. As you see, it's a gravitational production because I'm putting this in a sector gravitationally coupled to the inflaton. But you can see that essentially the source of scalar perturbation is a mass. Instead, the source of gravity waves is a quadrupole moment, which is going to be proportional to the momentum. So if your source is non-relativistic, you have the mass much greater than the momentum, and there is a big cancellation in the tensor source. So what you mean is that you produce much fewer gravity waves than scalar perturbations. So you need essentially to modify the model if you really want to produce source gravity waves, and the source should be relativistic. Both rules are satisfied in this model that we wrote, where essentially sigma is a pseudoscalar, which is not the inflaton. Sigma is rolling during inflation. So as you see, it's very similar to the previous calculation, but the only difference is that now this is happening in a sector which is only gravitationally coupled to the inflaton. Due to helicity considerations, if you do this calculation, and due to the fact that now the field A is relativistic, you indeed can produce more gravity waves than scalar perturbations. And actually, we missed one effect that was pointed out by Ferreira and Slot in a very nice paper, that if you have a vector field, it will produce perturbations of sigma. And as long as sigma and phi are both rolling, you have a linear coupling between delta sigma and delta phi. This was a channel that we didn't consider in our calculation that unfortunately still produces a lot of scalar perturbations. So, absolutely. Yes, super horizon, they are frozen. So this is just a source that is taking place maximally at next to horizon crossing. Well, you need to solve, right? This is the standard equation, which you need to solve. And from the... Yeah, you can also see the scale factor here. So once you do physically, you get what you expect, right? If you have a microscopic source, it will not modify anything on large scales. So the source has maximally effect next to horizon crossing. This is true for scalar and for gravity waves. And in order to address this final point, we came up with the third rule, that the source should be effective only for a limited amount of time. In this case, there is less time for the linear conversion. Delta source goes to delta phi. And also in this way, you can imagine tuning your model such that you get an effect only at the scales you want. As I say, it's very tuned, but that's what you can do. For example, if you have an effect only at a multiple L smaller than 100, then you have weaker limits from non-Gaussianity. Essentially, we are cheating, right, by putting the signal where we want. So we're going to have a bump of a scalar perturbation as non-gravity waves on scale that left the horizon when the source was effective. The tuning related in the model, you see, we can take the simplest potential for a pseudoscalar. That's the simplest you could write down there, for typically from an axion. And what we tune the mass to be comparable to H, so that we are considering situation where the rolling of sigma only takes place for order one number of e-folds, three or four e-folds. So sigma is tuned to start there. It's going to be maximally fast in the middle point. And if the mass is tuned to be comparable to H, this roll will only happen for a few e-folds. That's what we need to do. And here, the calculations are very long. They took me months to do it, but then we only did a very simple check. I don't plan to do any many detailed study on the model, because clearly the model is very tuned. I just want to show an existence proof. And here we are showing situations where essentially you get not too big modification of the scalar perturbations, but big modification of the gravity waves. And unfortunately, you are missing what you should see here to get anything out of this plot here. But let me first just say, here we are, the colors are just three different choice of parameters. You see in red I have a bump here, in green I have a bump here, and in blue I have a bump there. And these are compatible with the TT limit at 2 sigma. These are the WMAP paper, WMAP data, but there's not much difference at those case. And here we get the source gravity waves. Now, if you could see it, I see a Canadian thing. So there's going to be, in the case of scale invariant, R 10 to the minus 1 is something like here. In the scale of scale invariant, 10 to the minus 2 is something like this. 10 to the minus 3, something like that. It would be nice to see the dotted lines that you cannot see in this figure here, because they tell us what the bumps are relative to a scale invariant thing. But the message I want to give is that you can get R, which is visible and large, without producing a too big change of the scalar perturbations. And if you're interested, you can look at my screen later where you can see the lines. So suppose this is the case. How can I distinguish this from the vacuum mechanism? Where I can distinguish from the fact that this is not what you obtain in a scale invariant case. So if you can measure a window, you can distinguish this from a scale invariant. But also you can distinguish it from the non-Gaussianity. Here, again, is hardly seeing. This is the signal to noise for detection of BBB in these models. This is one. The solid lines is what you would get from Planck. The dotted lines that go here, so this is 1, 10, 100. These are the signal to noise for BBB in a cosmic variance limited experiment of gravity waves. You can tell me I'm crazy, of BMOS, right? You can tell me I'm crazy, but that's just to indicate you how good you can get. So the message is that if you see BB, then you can do additional tests, which hopefully could give us a hint whether it's a sourced or a vacuum signal. Here, I want to be quick, let me be very quick. So I'm going to just not go into the description at all. Let me just give the two bullets over there. First, I want to say that the vacuum mechanism for gravity waves is very robust, because I just show you rules that you need to satisfy in order really to see a source signal. So this is very fine-tuned. And second, I want to say that if you really want, you can do it. In our model, you can get visible R at arbitrary small vacuum scale of inflation. But of course, it's a very tuned model. So let me move to the third part of my talk, and I will not have time really to go through here. The third part is a model that I always liked a lot. And I always wanted to study, but never had the courage to do it until I decided, okay, now I want to do it. That's how we started to study this model essentially last summer. And we are about to finish, so hopefully we'll post the paper next week. The idea is that you know that inflation, you need a very flat potential. And of course, already now even the quadratic potential is ruled out. And secondly, in many models, you have excursion of the inflaton that is greater than Planckian. This could have not clear compatibility with quantum gravity, I don't really know. But also, the bigger the inflaton moves, the bigger is the region that you have to tune to be flat. And so all operators need to be constrained on that bigger region. So the question is, what can happen if you have a motion which is different than the usual one. If you have, for example, if you have a motion that is controlled by dissipation. And that is what, to my knowledge, was started by Barrera long ago with the idea of warm inflation, essentially. And trapped inflation is a very nice model that realizes this idea in a concrete way with a minimum field content so that calculations can be done more easily. The basic idea is a repetition of burst of particle production that I was telling you before. So now there's going to be different fields chi I that are produced whenever phi is phi zero I. There are many thresholds, and which maybe you can motivate by some periodicity, like in monodromy. And at each moment, you're going to produce quanta of the field chi. As you are producing them, you can see that you produce them with the Gaussian profile, and then they get diluted by the expansion of the universe. So each field gets produced, diluted, but you have many of them. And the basic idea is that if the set phi zero I is dense, you can have a continuous friction, so something that keeps getting stopped by particle production. Of course, the field chi will also produce inflaton perturbations and metric perturbations. That's what we are interested to compute. And I really liked the model. I wanted to study it. Moreover, it was a paper with Samir. So the initial motivation was just to learn the model and to update the constraints, since there are much improved CMB data since when the original model was done. So by doing that, we've learned quite a lot. And hopefully, we are going to post our paper next week. What we do, we follow the original system of equation. This by itself is non-trivial. They did a very nice job of setting up the equations. We study them, we agree with them, and that's already very non-trivial. And there's also some constraints, and we agree with all what they wrote there. But what we change with respect to them, we change the solution of this set of equations. Essentially, they have some approximation which misses order one factors. But these order one factors, in our calculation, they conspire to give a 10 to the minus 4 factor at the end. And essentially, it's something that you really need to do the calculation to see it. So what we find, we just find something that is very similar to what they find, but it just has a different number. Due to this 10 to the minus 4 difference, you need to change the parameter dependence, and you get very different results, essentially. So this small number will give a different result on the phenomenology of the model. That's at least what we find in our calculation. What we also do, we extend their system to second order in the inflaton perturbations, and we find that the second order perturbations are smaller than the first order perturbation. In their paper, they have an opposite identity, an opposite inequality, so which makes it harder to trust. But at least in our calculation, that's what we find. So let me just discuss very simply the simplest model you can imagine. So you have a model where there is a quadratic inflaton potential. So there are four parameters: the mass of the inflaton, the value g of the coupling, the number of ifolds that we fix to 60, and the distance between instances of particle production. So you take one instance minus the other. The difference is what you call delta, is also a parameter of the model. And by enforcing the normalization of the power spectrum, you can enforce delta as a function of the other two parameters. So you can present everything in a two-dimensional parameter space. Now, I won't bother you in the details because time is almost over. But essentially, what you do, you can really check by just looking at the equation of motion. There's going to be an extra term. You take, here is just for the background level. You take the expectation value of the extra term. You just do the calculation. You substitute the sum with the integral, which you can do if you have a dense instances of particle production. And you end up with a new term in the zero order equation for the inflaton field. And there is a new attractor solution, where essentially the last term dominates the Hubble, over the Hubble in the friction of the inflaton. And you get a different slow-roll solution for the inflaton. And you get a bunch of constraints that need to be satisfied. It's a difficult calculation, so you get a lot of constraints. There are constraints that determine slow roll, I'm not showing them here, C1 and C2. C1 and C2 are constraints that they're the usual slow-roll constraint that we can just use them to use to determine the beginning and the end of inflation. Then there is the solid lines are upper limits. You need to be below solid lines. The dotted lines are lower limits. You need to be above solid lines. C3 is the defining condition of trapped inflation. You need to be below C3 line so that the particle production dominates the friction. C4 is a condition for the particles to be produced fast enough. If the particles are not produced fast enough, you don't have trapped inflation. And the other constraints, C5, C6, C7, C8, are just constraints that ensure the validity of our calculation. If these constraints are evaded, you still have trapped inflation, but you cannot trust the analytic system that they did and that we did. So C5 to C8 are just technical constraints in order for our calculation to be correct. But at the end, we can only say something in this very narrow region, which is going to be the one that satisfies all of the constraints. Let me skip all the calculation and just give you the result. First of all, we find that it's indeed possible to have an excursion smaller than Planckian. So the three relevant constraints are shown there in blue with the three contour lines. The contour lines are the value of the inflaton in Planckian units, 6 CFOs before the end of inflation. You know, in the standard case, you get 15 Planck mass. And you can see that on the line C3, essentially, is the line below which particle production is important. The more particle production is important, the smaller will be the range scanned during inflation. So you can really have regions where you have sub-Planckian evolution. We find a spectral tilt that is not consistent with observation if this parameter delta is constant. So we change delta to be depending on the inflaton. Delta, remember, is the difference between particle production. And this is what you need to have spectral tilt in agreement with observation. Then, as I was telling in the second part of the talk, in this model, the source is not relativistic. So you get very little gravity waves. 10 to the minus 2 R, 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus, no, sorry, 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 10. So in this model, there is really no way to get source gravity, so to get gravity waves. And the most important result that we obtain is that when you compute FNL, you get essentially minus 2 independently of the parameters. This is something that is very technical, and I will not really have time now to discuss. If you want, I can discuss in person. But this is a true prediction of the model, because essentially, whatever the parameters are, you expect FNL given by this result here, which in principle is a very robust prediction according to our results. I'm done, so let me just conclude. So I did essentially three different classes of models. First, I discussed my original models where led me to this field, essentially discussion of coupling in axion inflation. And we obtain a limit, and this limit is really independent of whatever the gauge field is. So this limit applies to the coupling of the axion inflaton to whatever gauge field. The second point, we discuss CMB gravity waves, whether it's possible to have source gravity waves. And the problem, you see, is that you really need to produce gravity waves without disturbing scalar perturbations. This is very hard to achieve. We show an existence proof, but I find it quite ugly. So the main result is that you can do it if you want, but really the standard mechanism is quite robust. Thirdly, we get some updated results in trapped inflation. We really enjoy the paper and we follow a lot of things as they do. We just get different numerical results that give a different phenomenology. Okay, thank you very much. Yes? How much back? First? Oh, yes.
Is that R of 10 in the upper plot there?
So the upper plot is the value of the inflaton 6 CFOs before the end of inflation. So the line, the red line is phi 60 is 10 M Planck, yellow line phi 60 is M Planck, violet line 0.1 M Planck. Is the excursion of the inflaton in the final 6 CFOs of inflation.
So, and what is the value of R you get for that?
The value of R is described here, 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 10. You see,
what you're getting
No, I wish. I wish. That would be nice. But you see, this ties up with the second part of my talk. In this model, the source is non-relativistic, and therefore you don't really produce too many gravity waves. And that's consistent with what you see in this plot here.
But then in that case, you're not getting gravity waves with no excursion of the field, which is fairly standard.
Well, I was not surprised to get this, to be honest, but because it's consistent with what I was getting from previous papers. So I think that the more interesting result related to this, as also was the original motivation, is the relation with non-Gaussianity, right? And what is interesting is that we find something that seems not to depend on the parameter. So that would be a very strong way to rule out the mechanism.
Maybe there's something I misunderstood about this, but you've got the two steeper dotted lines, and you said that on that same plot.
Yeah, but let me show them here because I can remember.
The calculation was only valid above these.
Let me give you an example.
Let me ask my question, maybe it's clear.
Sorry.
You said the calculation was only valid above these two lines, but in these plots, you've shown predictions for many regions which are not above the leftmost lines. So how do you know that the predictions?
Very good. I don't. Very good. Very good point. I should say it. Very good. This is the only region where I trust my calculation. So above there.
Will remain straight.
There are lions, right, as they would say. I don't really know. The calculations are not valid here, but at least I can see what they are in this region. Yes, absolutely.
So in the sourced gravitational wave part of your talk, you flashed the slide where you showed the TTBB and the BBB. So the bump in TT, I guess I'm surprised it's so small given the fact that the tensor contribution is like orders of magnitude bigger. Is that just because the tensor-tensor transfer function is
okay, let me say something I didn't emphasize too much in the talk. Epsilon phi was chosen to be 10 to the minus 5, so that our vacuum is 10 to the minus 4. So, for example, let me go back to my hockey stick. This is, for example, about r 10 to the minus 1, about r 10 to the minus 2. So what we are really saying is that our gravity wave sourced are much greater than gravity wave vacuum. However, we are not saying that R is of order 1, but R can be compatible between 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 3. That's where 10 to the minus 3 would be, and that's where 10 to the minus 1 would be.
Okay.
If you could see the lines, it would be clearer, but unfortunately, they don't show.
I have another question.
Yes?
The equation, the effective equation that includes the back reaction of the electric and magnetic fields on the scalar.
Yes.
So it's just a question of how that's derived and why that's an effective equation. Is this derived from some perturbative expansion, and that's why we don't know what
okay.
it is?
Okay. What you do is the following, right? This was the source. The source is just delta A, delta A, delta phi that just comes from expanding the term phi FF tilde, right? So this will give me delta phi E dot B. There is another contribution that needs to be there, is that this essentially E dot B, once you get the VEV, it will be related to Xi, and Xi is a function of phi dot. And what they did, Sorbo and Amber, they just wrote phi dot plus delta phi dot. So this effectively produces an interaction when you expand in perturbation theory between this and this, which is going to be the term that you see there. However, and I'm not criticizing that because they discuss all this very well. However, you can imagine that there will be other things, right? At some point here, you would have to have gradient of delta phi entering. So in principle, consistently, maybe you should introduce things which are of the type gradient dot E dot B, which at some point, they all need to become important. So they argued, and is arguably, right, that since psi is proportional to phi dot, maybe the first non-trivial effect will be from the expansion of delta phi dot. But they don't really have an exact calculation. I believe that you should maybe a more systematic expansion and verify that this term
is really subdominant. Or maybe you should solve this in a lattice, right? So I think that what they do is correct. It catches probably what is the leading term. But then, so let me just go to the final slide. Maybe what they do is good here, right? Oh, I didn't need to. What they do is good here. But do we trust that this equation is valid up to there? And I think nobody knows, right? That's the point. OK?
All right, there are no more questions.
Thank you. Thanks.